Coming up on this episode.
How many papers are you able to get out?
I've got 100 publications and I am publishing a rate of a paper a month.
A paper a month?
Yes.
In meta-analysis?
Yeah. So this brings me to what I actually wanted to talk about today, apart from the jokes, which is because I think we discussed the audience you have for the podcast.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about something I haven't talked about before, which is organization within research or research teams. Now, the first thing to understand with research is no research can be done in isolation. You can't do research by yourself. You know, this is idea of this mad scientist or Iron Man, Iron Man going and inventing, you know, his Iron Man suit in the middle of a cave in Afghanistan. Yeah, it's ridiculous and it does not work because a lot of research is time consuming and painful and is boring work and takes time. So you don't want to do that. You don't want to do boring work which takes time. So that's one problem with research. With research, so there's a lot of data. There's a meta-analysis published showing, you know, medical students involved in research, and it's about 73% overall of medical students are interested in research, which is quite a large number. And it varies from country to country, much higher in developed countries. And up to 30% of medical students, according to that same meta-analysis, which looked at data from lots of different medical colleges throughout the world, is up to 30% of medical students are interested in some sort of research career. Which is great. These are quite high percentages. And a lot of people get involved in research. And the overall publication rate for medical students who get involved in research is about 50%, which is actually not too bad, considering that if you look at the International Trials Database, only 50% of all trials are published. And up to 28% of papers coming out of academic centers have medical student authors. But I do have an issue with research failure. Nobody likes to fail. Nobody likes to be a failure. But there are huge issues with failing. And the biggest one is opportunity cost. Opportunity cost means, like, for example, when we left Brexit, you know, it's a problem, isn't it? Or the one that got away. Let's say you wanted to marry your perfect mate, She would have made you happy.
Yeah.
But you didn't. And you ended up unhappy.
Okay.
So you didn't end up in the Tom Hanks movie where he meets Meg Ryan, you know, at the end, he meets her after 10 years. He ends up marrying somebody else randomly, and he's unhappy. So there's to failure, there's an opportunity cost. There's a cost to failure. Failure is very, very bad. Failure turns off people against research. So you cannot fail.
That's when bias comes in.
Well, so how do you not fail? So why do projects fail? The first thing is there is a lack of organization. So, for example, I say to John, who's sitting in the chair there, let's imaginary John. John has got glasses and he's got a long beard and he looks a bit like Santa Claus, but just to test it, you know. So Santa Claus John, actually, you know, we did one of our cardiac physiologists, He basically, he does look a bit like Santa Claus. And then I think I was once given a message that there's a guy who looks like Santa Claus. And Santa Claus was asked to take this balloon pump to another hospital. And to this day, I told my physiology colleague, there was actually you in your Santa Claus form who gave me that message. So anyway, so let's say you've got a guy, So you have to remember that he's coming to you with certain things. He's the self-selection bias. He's interested in the research, He's got motivation. He's here. He made the time to come and see you. So then there are a few other things that are required. One is he needs to give you a time commitment. You need to give him a time commitment. So that means that you cannot take on a person as a supervisor when you are not able to give them time. This is where a lot of projects fail. The supervisor is not created time. You cannot supervise an unlimited number of projects. You should only be able to supervise, let's say, 10 or 12 maximum projects. And for each of those projects, you need to create time. So you need to say to that person, how much time can you give me? So let's say he gives you 30 hours or 40 hours. And you have to remember that there is also a time that you're not talking about 30, 40 hours over 2 years. You're talking about 30, 40 hours in 2 months. 6 weeks to 2 months. So a good research project with a medical student should be short. Otherwise, you should pay them.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
You should pay them. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to maintain their loyalty. He's going to go and have exams, other things. Yeah. So it's not going to work unless you have that thing. So using the Santa Claus analogy again, you know, Christmas is coming. We need to prepare all the presents, the elves, everybody needs to work together. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have, because all these children will be crying otherwise after Christmas. I personally think that Santa Claus, I tell my children Santa Claus is a burglar. And if he comes through the chimney, I'm going to beat the crap out of him. Yes. He can't go through people's houses without permission. So anyway. So.
Yeah.
I feel there are four things that you need to do to get a research project off with your main person. First of all, you need to have one main person. That's absolutely critical. I went and I did a lot of research, which wasn't as successful as I thought. I went and read a lot of management books and thought about it for a long time. And so I've come up with this technique, which is that, first of all, when you start working with this person, you need to know a lot about them. Can they give you a time commitment? Are they intelligent enough? Or do they have all the abilities? Do you know this person? You need to know about this person. What is going on in their life? In exams, or you know, if they're older, you know, are they getting married? They've got a girlfriend? Is there other things going on in their life? You need to know a bit about them. You need to be friendly with them. So that you need to sort of develop that sort of relationship with them, because the project is 100% nearly dependent on this one person. Success, failures. I discuss this with people, and sometimes people say, oh, you should keep a second person or whatever. No. Or you go all in. You're going all in on this one person. But this one person needs certain things from you. So that brings us to the four steps, which I feel are necessary. First is, you do an induction meeting and training. You need to train them. Yeah, you need to teach them a certain skill. So what I do with meta-analysis, I try and teach them the different steps of meta-analysis and programming language. Because stats is the lifeblood of research. So I try and teach them a bit of R.
Mm.
Yeah? Stats is the absolute lifeblood of research. No research can be done without stats. Otherwise, you're just a data entry person.
Yeah.
And a data entry person is easily replaceable. So you need to know stats as a researcher. Yeah, you need to know your numbers. You don't need to be good at them, and you don't need to know a lot of numbers. You drive a car. Do you know how the engine works? Not really. You need to just know how to turn it on, how to turn the gears, all of that.
Yeah.
So you need to know how the car actually runs. You need to know a few rules of the road. So you didn't need to know R as a programming language. You need to be able to access the functions. You need to be able to install the programs. You need to be able to access the functions. You need to know where to cut and paste the code from. You don't need to know the code.
Yeah.
Yeah? So that sort of stuff. Training. So training means not just, it's also psychological. So you go sit with that person and you say, you know, you find out about them, you show them you're interested in that person, and then you train them in something specific. And then what I do is I do something I call reverse meta-analysis, which is that meta-analysis is based on a number of complex steps. And the complex steps are, you first of all, you decide on the topic, then you do screening. Yeah, you do a search and then you do screening of the abstracts. So what you're looking for is these papers that you're going to combine. You need to find them. So you choose a topic, you do a search, screening, then you do the data entry. Yeah, so you take out the data from each of those papers, which is like demographics data, like male, female, ages. Then you take out the outcome data. Did the treatment work? Did it not work? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you finally do the number crunching, the analysis. Now, I think this is a very bad way of doing a meta-analysis. This is a terrible way, because people will lose interest, man. You're starting the screening and they're doing all this boring looking at abstracts. And then you say, oh, then we're going to move on to the next bit, which is data entry. That's again very, very boring. And then we're going on to the next bit. So the problem is people will lose interest. This is not the right way to do it. No. We just move on to the exciting stuff. So you say, we are going to do the hardest step first. So yeah, we're going to jump straight to the top of the mountain. So we're going to do a forest plot. So the way we do it, the way I design, you choose a topic for meta-analysis, for example. And I'm just, we're going to go back to our four steps, but I just want to go through the steps that we do when we decide a topic, is that a meta-analysis only works if you have a good topic. So imagine, Andres, you went to the Himalayas, yeah?
Yeah.
And you took all your equipment and you spent £30,000 to get there and you bought all these expensive picks and oxygen masks and stuff like that. And then you climbed some mountain and you came back. They say, which climb, mountain to climb? You say, oh, I don't know. I climb mountain Imran Khan, which is the name for the Prime Minister of Pakistan. And everybody say, Dumbo, did you climb Mount Everest? I say, no. Did you climb K2? You say, no. They said, why did you waste £30,000? Like, you won't get any coverage. Nobody will care about you. So you climbed the wrong mountain.
Yeah.
First of all. So climbing the so choosing a topic is very, very important in meta-analysis. So climbing the and this, in fact, applies to the same person. You need to choose the right person as well. Yeah? So it's in the same way. You need to choose, yeah? It's like choosing a life partner. You need to choose it properly. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Don't let Meg Ryan get away, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you remember Meg Ryan? No?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. This is not my cup of tea, but it's fine. Tom Hanks seemed to like her. So what you do is you go to a journal in your field, a top journal. Mm-hmm. Let's say I look at Jack. And I look at last 6 months. I do a search and say, last 6 months, these original papers were published. That means these are fashionable topics. People are interested. This is like, you know, the fashionable dress that's come out of the M&S. Yeah? This is non-compaction, for example. Non-compaction is the important topic. Or LV thrombus is the hot topic, yeah, at this moment. So I found a paper on this. Okay, interesting. I search. Usually every topic has a meta-analysis. Oh, there's a meta-analysis done 2 years ago. Great. So that means 2 years is like a good round number. Oh, how many new papers have come out since then? So I've already found a new paper, so I only need to find one more. So I found one more new paper. Two new papers, meta-analysis done 2 years ago. Yeah? Mm. We're nearly in business. There's one more question. How many papers in this meta-analysis? So is it 10? Is it 20? Is it 30? Is it 40? Oh, is it 40? No, I don't want to. I don't like to work hard. That's the point with research, isn't it? You are not paying these people, yeah?
Yeah.
You need to understand that this project will never get finished if it's big. It needs to be a small project.
Yeah.
So, you know, 20 papers, 30 papers, that's fine. But bigger than that, no. Won't work. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. So, that's how you choose the topic. So, I meet this person, get friendly with them, understand them, give them my number, they have my number, they can communicate with me. And then we'll communicate quite regularly, and I give them a bit of training. Yeah, training is important. And I train them in different aspects of the project. And after the teaching, I should say, after the teaching, then I have to do some work. I have to make sure that this person and the people who are going to join the project in the future, everything is ready for them. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like kindergarten. You come in and, you know, all the boxes of toys are there. They put the toys out and then you play with them, yeah? So do you understand? So in essence, you need to have the stuff ready. So if they need to do work on some spreadsheets, they need to be there. You need to do reference. If references are required, you need to know which references they are. So if they're going to do some data entry stuff for you, you know, you need to make sure all the information is there for them. So you need to make sure things are ready. People work better when they come into organized environments. So you sit down with this person, you show them, let's say, for example, this first person we started with. You show them the previous paper. You show them the new papers, which we've found through PubMed search. Simple PubMed search is fine at this point. And then you say, okay, this is how you use R. Then can you generate some forest plots? And they generate the forest. And you work with them. And you give them your number. And you say, you can text me anytime, day or night, and I will respond. And I will help you. And we'll meet regularly. You meet every week and stuff like that. And that way, the project starts working. Because then that person generates the forest plot. And then the result is there. The result of the paper. So you got that first. It's a bit like, you remember the story of the chicken who grew some wheat and then made some bread?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Fine. So there was this chicken, yeah?
Yeah.
A hen. And she had some wheat. She plants it into the ground. She says, all the other animals, fox and cow and whatever, can you help me? They don't help her. So then she grows it and waters it and they don't help her. She asks for help. They don't help her. Then she grows and then takes it out and then she takes it to the mill. And she said, can somebody take it to the mill? Nobody helps her. Then she brings it back. She bakes it. Can somebody help me with the baking? Nobody helps her. Then she makes the bread. And then they all said, we want to help you eat it. And she says, no, I'm going to eat it myself. But this is like the stupidest story ever. Because how can you just eat bread? Like, who can eat bread? Have you ever heard of eating bread by itself?
People used to do it, I guess. Not now.
I know, but it's like boring, isn't it? If she had asked the others to come, somebody would have brought butter, somebody would have brought condiments, somebody would have brought drink, somebody would have brought a tablecloth, table, you know, knife. What's going to do it? Bread like this, and you just stuff it in her mouth. So my point is that if people can see a result, this is about tangibility. This is the problem with research. Is in research, there are a lot of things are not visible. Like, for example, when you're a doctor or a medical student, you go up and you see a patient. He's concrete, he's real, he's a person. He's got a medical condition. Oh my God, he's got a valve. Oh my God, I can hear his metal valve. So, you know, you are interested. It's real. And then after that, you write down your history, present to somebody, he gives you an assessment. It's all very real. Mm. Research has none of that. There's nothing. There's some random person telling you an idea. And there's a lot of, in research, there's a lot of fantasy stuff. I've met a lot of research people. Like, I used to have one of my bosses, and he was telling me his grand idea was to take all these bone samples. He was an orthopedic surgeon, and then create a gigantic genetic database, and everybody would want a genetic database. We all knew it was complete fantasy. It was like a ridiculously stupid idea because, you know, it just wouldn't work in the way he was trying to describe it, and where was it the funds, where would he store it, and all of that.
Yeah.
So he was just a pie in the guy, man. He got to professorship in the end. Yeah, but the problem is that this sort of pie in the sky stuff is very common in research, and you need to avoid that. You need to make it lay on much more solid foundation so that you work with that person, so you've taught them, you made sure the stuff is there for that person to use, so you help them install R or whatever, and you give them all the information and stuff. You make sure all the tools are there. You can't ask a workman to come into your house and fix your tap and then he doesn't have the tools. You need to make sure the tools are there. This is about organization, yeah? People respond to work in organized environments. Nobody responds to a disorganized environment.
How much work do you put in before someone comes in? Hours of work? Because what you're describing...
A little bit, because the problem is a lot of stuff is reused.
Okay, yeah.
But I've made the PowerPoints and stuff for how to understand R, etc. in advance. So it's fine. It's not that difficult. It doesn't take that much time. So then... The next bit, so the first is teaching, then making sure the equipment, etc., that this stuff is there. That's my job. Then they do the job and I help them. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So this is the actual doing. And then they do the job and then I make sure they check, they send their WhatsApp, their forest plots, etc. to me. I look at them and say, do this and do that and whatever. And so we correct them. And then there's the evaluation phase. The evaluation phase is like the weekly meeting, which is informal. To be honest, the person who's working with me sees only the informality. They only see, being friendly. But there is an organized structure in my mind, which is that I have an agenda for the meeting, but he may not necessarily see it in the beginning. So I'll go through it. I don't have a reminder meeting. You can't do a meeting where you just remind them to do their job. It's more about, let's look at the details of this and look at the details of that and whether you're having any issues with this. And then that reminder meeting works really well. Usually I try to have it as a physical meeting. If not, then a Zoom meeting. And that works really well, and we discuss things and we joke around. And do you have any interviews or do you have this and stuff? You keep it light, yeah. Mm-hmm. Never tell people off.
Yeah? Never tell people off.
Never do this. Bad idea. They're working for you for free.
Of course.
So obviously, why would you want to do that?
How would you tell them that they're not doing something correct?
Well, there's only three outcomes, isn't there? It's when in the evaluation phase, there are only three possible outcomes. One is they've lost their way, which is you have to tell them how to do it. The second is that they're successful, which is most of the time, and they've done, and you say, yes, you've done this successfully. The third is that the project has failed and you need to terminate it. There are only three outcomes. You have to decide between the three. So that's the evaluation phase. You should do the evaluation weekly.
Weekly
evaluation. Okay. So that's the first. Then what you do is the forest plot is now generated. So the forest plot is now generated, and now you have a tangible result. Everybody can see, oh my God, you got results. And then people see, okay, on the forest plot, in a meta-analysis, what you see is you combine all the papers and see if the treatment works or not, for example. And you have multiple outcomes. Oh, it reduces stroke, it reduces heart attack, it reduces death, it has these adverse effects. So those become your outcomes. So what you're doing is you're taking the previous one, you're adding on some data, you're creating a new one. And then everybody can see it, and then they're like, oh my God, we want to work with you. So then you start bringing other people into the project. But the steps still apply. Training, making sure the equipment is there, and then a little bit of supervision during the phase, and then evaluation, So all of those projects. So then you say to one person, why don't you write the intro? So you get some registrar who's like, not keen. So a lot of, for example, registrars or senior people who are not keen on doing the work of data entry, but they'll be very happy to write an intro for you. So you write the intro. Then another person, you say, okay, can you do the screening? So you pick one or two medical students who just want to do, they don't want to be involved in nuts and bolts of the whole project, but they're happy to do one task. So you say, okay, you do the screening. So you do the search, upload it for them, and say, just do the screening. We already know the papers, but just look through it quickly. And then another group, you say, do the demographics, most of the demographics on the old paper, can you just fill out these tables and they'll do it for you. And then usually the person who's done the forest plot at this point write the methods, and usually they can do the risk of bias. Risk of bias is a quality assessment of the papers. This is a good paper, this is a bad paper. This paper wasn't randomized properly. Yeah?
Mm.
And then somebody writes the discussion. Now this, as a technique, which I call a reverse meta-analysis, works really well in real life. Yeah, works really, really well.
I got a question. So let's say the medical students you put to do the screening find another meta-analysis.
They won't find another meta-analysis, but they will find another paper.
Or another paper, for example. What do you do after that?
Modify. You've run the code already. What's adding one more paper?
Okay.
That's not the final result. That's fine. These things are accepted. That's improvement. That's the process of improving the paper. It's collaborative. So at every step, people will generate new ideas. Somebody will say, I was doing the intro and have you looked at this bit? Or could you have done this? So a lot of the best ideas come from collaboration from other people, where you create an open environment where people are always willing to say what they want to do. So for example, in medicine, the environment is very poor. Like if you go up to a ward, so I was describing this to my wife, and she was a bit shocked. I said to her that when the consultant comes in the ward, everybody has to stop what they're doing. They literally, the consultant says, I want to start my ward round, they have to stop what they're doing and they follow the consultant. You are not allowed to give advice because he just tells you what to do. You're not allowed to challenge him in any way, shape, or form. Have you seen this? You've seen this, haven't you?
Yeah.
So he doesn't ask for advice. 99% of the time, he just tells you to do something. You are given no choice in the matter. You literally cannot go to the toilet without permission. does this happen in any of the workplaces? So this is why in the UK, we have such high levels of sexual harassment. Whereas at this moment in time, if you go and read the GMC cases, the GMC, the number one cause of doctors being struck off at this moment is sexual harassment. Number
what?
One. Yeah, because all these historical cases are coming out. Mr. Consultant abused, was basically, what they do is they blur the boundaries. So they'll have like a female house officer, a female house officer, after female house officer every 4 months. So they'll blur the boundaries, say, I want to teach you something. Or they start saying inappropriate things, And they start getting friendly and start touching. Or I want to teach you how to do an echo, and they'll take her to a black room, dark room, and start touching and stuff. And they won't do anything beyond that. And they do it enough that the person tolerates it. But they don't do a formal report, but they can start complaining to the nurses and the other doctors. The colleagues will say, he's just like that. Yeah? It's very difficult to get rid of somebody in a permanent job in the NHS. You know, there's one of the people who's head of the GMC's committee, which basically takes these cases and strikes doctors. He said, one of the things I found is so difficult to get rid of a consultant.
So?
Difficult to get rid of a consultant, to fire them. Very difficult. So that is a system which leads to more error because nobody ever gives their opinion. So where you go to a system where you are open and let everybody give an opinion, and so like that, it works much better. So anyway, so we've got to the phase where we have now gone from one person who's generated the forest plot, as I touched on, into a mode where you are now massively expanding the project in an extremely organized manner. And now we are looking toward publications. This is where the project becomes really fast. So you can generate a forest. So I have one guy who completed a meta-analysis, medical student, within 1 month. 1 month, he's done it, two papers. Yeah. So basically, he came, he did the forest plot with me, then he gave two people, I got two people to screen, he wrote the methods, he got another person to help him write the discussion, and then he got, I think he did the demographics himself. It was a simple paper. He didn't use R, he used RevMan, which is an easier way to do it. But still, he managed to complete it.
Yeah.
And there's another guy who did it in 2 months. So I'm just saying, the technique works.
Yeah.
It requires time commitment, but I have seen it work quite well. And I think this, I have discussed with one of my bosses who's basically one of the top two people in cardiology meta-analysis in the UK. And he said, yeah, this is the right way to do it. He always asked for the forest plot himself. First. So it's an extremely easy way to do meta-analysis.
How many hours per week do you put in it?
Oh, that's interesting. So that would require describing my schedule. So my schedule is difficult. It's difficult. I wouldn't recommend it to most people. I haven't followed it for last week because I was quite ill. And I don't know, flu, possibly COVID, but I didn't test it. So yeah. I wake up at 4:40 in the morning. And then I meditate and stuff for 2 hours, which is important. Otherwise, you won't be sane in this job, yeah? If you don't meditate. Meditation. So meditation and travel and all that. So, but I start straight away. Because I went to this website called morningroutine.com. It had everybody's morning. Ivanka Trump's morning routine. Lazy slacker. But I'm just joking. No, she's because of 5:30. So there's all these morning routines. And all these people just get up and I'm drinking my coffee and I'm just walking around. And it's like, really, is that how you do it? Like, I'm up and I am straight at it. Yeah?
Yeah.
So 4:40, get ready within 4 or 5 minutes, and then meditation, whatever. And then 6:40, try to be at work. 6 o'clock. So this is where the preparation bit comes in. So 6:40 is onwards. For the first hour, I read statistics, and because I need to be ready. So Wayne Gretzky is a famous hockey player, yeah? He was that they used to say about him that he went where the puck is going to be rather than where the puck is, where all the other players before him used to go to where the puck they could see was going. Where the puck was, sorry. So the point is that I need to be ready. These people are going to ask me questions. They're going to have problems. I need to be ready for their problems. So I read in advance. So I'll read R and stuff like that for an hour. Sometimes I read management theory and things like that. So read for an hour. And that is preparatory reading. So I'm already ready for their questions. Yeah, or I'm creating material or creating PowerPoints and things like that. I'm creating material for them.
Mm-hmm.
So 1 hour. And then 40 minutes, I will take one of the projects and I'll do some work on it. Actual work. So I'll sit down and edit, or I'll do stuff for one of the projects that I'm doing. So I actually do work on it without being asked. It's not like being given a task. I'll just sit down and do stuff on it, and I'll send it to the guy. I said, I've done some work on this project, and this bit needs to be this way, this bit. The thing is that if you don't do that, this is why a lot of the projects die, because he thinks, I'm doing all the work, you're not doing anything. So you need to do something. So I'll sit down in 40 minutes, one of the projects, I'll do some work.
Mm.
And then I give another 20 minutes to emailing, texting people throughout the day. Mm. And a lot of time meetings, I'll do meetings in the middle of clinic. I'm always late in every single clinic. I'm running an hour behind or 2 hours because all these people are coming to meet me during clinic. But my patients never complain, so it's all right. I know how to calm them down. Well, I asked my juniors, what do? She said, you ask them so many random questions when they come in, they forget to complain. They've been waiting for an hour. So there's a way around it. Okay. So my patients never complain, which is very interesting. Even though if my colleagues did that to a patient for 1.5 hours, their patient, you tear their head off. But for me, it's no problem. Because, you know, it's fine. I'm used to it. So they never complain. So I have these research meetings, and all of these are in person. Person comes and we discuss a topic. And what I do, and it's very important, is that I don't finish the research meeting until we have discussed every single thing they want to discuss. Mm. And we look through everything in great detail. So I don't just like, oh, you've done well. No. Show me everything. We go through. Because he needs to see that I'm interested, and he needs to get advice from me, and I need to understand what he's doing.
Mm.
So it takes about 2 hours a day in total.
Excluding the weekend?
It's a bit complicated. Weekend, I do some other stuff. I do some like charity stuff, and I have some other interests. I'm interested in learning Arabic as a language and stuff like that. So I spend some time doing that. But it's a similar schedule, but it's just different topics.
And by doing this, how many papers are you able to get out?
I've got 100 publications, and I am publishing a rate of a paper a month.
A paper a month?
Yeah.
And it's usually meta-analysis?
Yeah. So I had a Cochrane review, March. I had a rheumatic heart disease paper in EHA Open in February. And I had January, I had a meta-analysis in JACC Imaging.
What? How's your mental health?
I meditate. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I mean, no, I don't think most people would want my life. Yeah, I would agree with that, because it's quite intense. But it's fine. I have a very heavy clinical burden, so I wouldn't recommend it for everybody. But it's very hard to do research and clinical stuff together. But it's fine, and you have to be very careful in time management. All my time is managed in the sense that, I spend time with my family. For example, at the moment, I'm on call. didn't realize unless you uncle bleep. So you have to make sure that you give time to your family. So I do that in the sense that I don't think working all the time is actually that helpful for most people. Mm-hmm. So I will say twice a week I'm going to stay late. So I'm on call as well at the same time. And then the other days I will go home, try and go home on some semblance of time. Yeah. So where I worked out is best to start early. Mm. So I start early, but obviously still some days I have to stay late because of a lot of clinical burden. But on the weekends I don't do any work. I don't do any work at home. So I keep this work. I think this is the problem with COVID. COVID has erased the work-home barrier, which is very dangerous. When people feel like they can message you and send you emails in 24 hours a day, that's so dangerous for a lot of my patients. Their mental health is being destroyed. Mm. So you have to keep that separation. You have to have interests outside of work as well, because it's not all about work. Because if you're the sort of person who's thinking, well, you know, work is going to give me happiness, then what if you get a GMC case? You know, there are 10 doctors a year nearly. Well, there at least 10 doctors. Although I'm going to double check that figure because the GMC has a slightly different figure, who commit suicide because they're reported to the GMC. Yeah, what? I had a consultant who was killed himself in Kent, BG Cliffs. He's a very nice guy. I really liked him, and he just the stress of work got too much for him.
What?
Yeah, so you just have to be careful that your identity is not a doctor. I do not call myself a doctor outside of work. I'm not a doctor outside of work. Then what is it? It's just a job. So if your identity is this, then if you lose it, then what are you going to do? So these people, when they lose their medical, you know, it's common, it's not uncommon. A lot of people can have problems. Some people have problems with medical issues, substance abuse. Some people have nasty divorces, other problems. You know, and they just burn out. But if being a doctor is your entire identity, then you've got nothing left. You need to have another identity. You need to be different from that. You need to be not just Dr. Andreas or whatever. Yeah. Dr. Andreas, medical student at the moment, but future doctor. But if you're that, then you are going to run in trouble at some point in your life.
Yeah.
So you need to have. So I meditate. And I exercise, which I run to the station.
Nice.
But that's pretty much it. So, no, I do a little bit of exercise on the weekend. You spend time with your family. But at home, I'm very, very careful that I fully concentrate on my family the entire time I'm home.
Do you switch off your phone?
No, I have my phone, but I try not to do any work stuff. To be honest, I'm. But then I have a slightly isolated life. I don't really have friends. All my free time is spent with my family. So they get a lot of attention from me.
Yeah.
And on the weekends as well. But I'm not really a social media person, no Twitter, no whatever.
I was going to ask you about this because we were talking about it and you were like, I don't believe, you know, you pick two things.
Yeah. So this is what you have to understand, that your time is extremely limited. So if you are, let's say, a medical student, and I've discussed this with quite a few medical students when they say they want to do research or something else.
Yeah.
I say what you cannot do is do three or four things. You have to, you can be a good medical student, and then you can have one more arrow in your quiver, which is that you can be a good teacher, you can be a manager, you can be parts of lots of societies and stuff. But what you cannot do is you cannot do research and do that. So if you're going to do research properly, you're going to have to not be involved in societies. You can't be involved in social media, which is a huge time waste for the most part, because it's a gainless activity 99% of the time. What are you gaining from social media? It's not really something that's getting you anywhere. You're spending a huge amount of time on it.
Mm.
So
it depends if you're a creator, I think, or a consumer.
Possibly. I mean, you could have that, but then you can't be a researcher. Because research requires time. And the problem with time is what you need to realize, that you also need time to unwind. You need time to sleep. You need time to eat. You need time to spend time with your family or friends.
Mm-hmm.
So if you allocate all of that time, then you realize there's no time left. So you can't have two interests. You can only have one.
Yeah.
This is what I've discussed with a lot of people. Otherwise, you'll either become a bad medical student, which means that you're going to not concentrate on your studies.
See? I guess it also depends a bit on the personality of the person as well, because there's some people that are they prefer to doing one thing and doing it well, and there's other people that are a bit more spread out. They have different interests, but they don't do them as well because you sacrifice quality.
Yeah, this is the problem. Quality issue. Yeah, because you're doing one thing a lot, and then the other thing, you're not going to be, no matter how much you tell yourself, you're not going to be able to do as well. So, for example, I'm mainly a clinician, so my research quality is not high. I know that. So the quality of the papers that I put out is not nowhere close that he does it full-time.
Yeah,
somebody's doing it full-time. His papers are, you know, Lancet and NEJM, for example. And I'm somehow sneaking my paper into a bigger journal, but obviously it doesn't deserve to be there. It's just some random shit. So
Sure they're good, yeah.
No, as a clinician, you actually do the clinical side as well. You contribute to the paper. Let's say somebody's done, like, as a data expert. And then you go in, oh, well, you know, rheumatic heart disease has these manifestations in the real patient. I said, okay. So you do that, but you sell your clinical side. So that's something you have to understand. That's what a lot of people who are involved in research do as clinicians, is that they're selling the clinical side. Yeah? But I think to be a good researcher, you need to be good with stats and data. And that is something that I'm not a good, as I told you, I'm not good at maths. We have to learn.
You teach other people, and then they do it.
Yeah, because it's boring. Like, once you start getting a large number of papers, what you realize is actually gets boring. So what is an extra paper going to gain me? Nothing. Yeah? It doesn't mean anything anymore. So what you want to do is you want to do something else. And what you want to do is then teaching is interesting. You know, I meet this medical student. He says, I want to do research. And I'm like an old bitter fogey. And, you know, he's kind of guy comes. And, oh, he's still got some fire in him. You know, he's excited. So I say, okay, let me teach you. And then he does all the steps. And he gets even more excited. Oh, my God, I got my forest plot. And then he learns a bit of management. He gives all these people tasks. And then the paper comes together. And then he's, like, really excited. And he's, like, then I don't even have to chase anymore. They're, like, texting me day and night. Oh, I've got this forest plot. I've got this problem. And then we continue communicating. And the paper's coming together and together. And there's more and more and more. And then he gets the whole paper together. And then I say, okay, it's time to submit. And then he submits, and that's been done. But, so, and then obviously through that process, you taught them something. That's the key aspect. You taught them something. So I'm trying to do it on a larger scale now. So I'm doing a lot of talks on how to do a meta-analysis. I've just done one on for the National Medical Student Research Association. And there were 100 people there. And I told them about this reverse meta-analysis. There were a few other things I wanted to tell you about the process. So one of them is that they need to, with that person, the relationship needs to be 100% direct, in the sense that that person knows that you're the main point of contact for everything. It's a bit like a marriage, because they need to come to you with all their queries, problems. And if you have a problem, you always go to them. You don't go to other people. You go always through that. That person is a single point of contact with the entire project. Yeah? And that way it works, because that person takes all the responsibility. So if you want somebody to write something, you don't say to that person, you write this. You say to your single point of contact, can you get this person to write you an intro? Yeah? That's very important. Your relation should be 100% toward each other, which seems bizarre, but it works well.
Because then you're micromanaging.
Yeah, you want that person to control the project.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, then they know that for everything, they don't want to ask you for help. You are going to help them. And you should be available. You should always answer their text messages, everything, immediately. So you are there to help them. But they are relying on you and nobody else for this research project. For that 6-week or 2-month period, it's very intense. The other motivational tools I use is that I show them other successful projects, you know, people who've had similar projects, they've had success, these are the techniques they use, this is how they did it, that works. And the other thing that works is that, you know, what are the advantages of doing this? And you show them that these people have published and they've had successful careers and they've got training numbers and they've got this and they've got that. So they see the end result of what they're going to get, and that also works. And then you can also explain to them that, you know, some people lost their way and this is how this happened, and they basically, their project went off track, but why did it go off track? If it does, I resuscitate the project. I don't give it up. I give it a few months and I think of carefully why the project failed. Why did it fail? And I start out with a new team. But the old team still gets their name on the paper, but I start with a new team. I wait a few months and then I think, why did it fail? Why? What went wrong? Because you have to think about that. And occasionally, you have to terminate the project. By termination, in essence, the person doesn't want to work with you anymore. It hasn't happened recently, but it does happen sometimes.
Any advice for students looking for a supervisor?
You need to find a supervisor who's a bit younger. I think that works. Like somebody who's not yet a professor. You'd be very tempted, oh, this guy's a professor. So, but the problem is they've already achieved whatever they wanted to achieve in life, isn't it? They've got their title. So what's the point? The other problem is that he already has too much on his plate. You're much more likely to be successful with somebody younger who is wanting to move up and therefore is willing to give that extra bit of time for you to take you forward. Because he has to give you a bit of extra time. Time that he doesn't have, but he will create for you, he or she. So you need to be a younger supervisor. Best supervisor is somebody who wants to become a professor but is not there yet.
Like
so
that.
He has some commitment into you.
Makes sense.
And that person's a bit rougher and is more. He's not as polished as a professor who will probably give you some weird boilerplate answer. Then yes, maybe there might be a chance for you, but he'll just tell you straight out, no, there's a chance for a project, there isn't. And what is the project? And he'll tell you. So it's better to work with a much younger supervisor always. But above all, you need to have the ability to persistence, organization, and the knowledge, like stats, and a project that is not open-ended. Open-ended projects are very dangerous. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you do surgical rotation. Yeah, this happens in a lot of houses. Do surgical rotation. The surgical consultant comes up, brings up 500 files. Oh, can you do the surgical audit for me? You know what? That surgeon in the consultant, has all the power in the world, He can make the access to the house officer go and take this blood sample to this building somewhere else, like a mile away, he'll do it. He'll do it immediately. He won't question, He says, consent, come in 6 o'clock in the morning, consent all my patients, he'll do it. So this guy will do anything this, but once he says, brings those 500 files, even the house officer has had it, and he'll do like 10, 15, he'll promise to do it, he won't do it, and then he'll rotate it out. So my point is, open-ended projects are not good for anybody. Open-ended projects do not get completed. By open-ended projects, I mean, what are the goals? When will they be accomplished? In what time? And if it's not closed, then, it's going to be a disaster. Because open-ended projects, as I said to you, have a huge, that fail, open-ended projects that fail due to, A, too much work, lack of organization, lack of supervision, choosing the wrong person to start out with who wasn't that keen on the project in the first place, and which are done in the wrong order, have a cost because that person then thinks, I don't want to do research anymore. I don't want to do this again. So there's a cost. That person, you've caused harm to that person by giving them a bad experience and wasting their time. That time they could have done, they could have done something else. They could learn how to play the violin. They could have gone and done a once-in-a-lifetime trip to Venice or something of the sort. They could have done something with their life. They could have gone to America and proposed to this person they found on the internet in that time, whatever, one thing to understand is also how people's psychology works. So the main person probably will give you, because you're giving them a huge time commitment, and you've chosen that person, and this is a person who's really interested in research and all that,
will
probably give you like 20 hours, maybe 30 hours, sometimes more.
Per month?
No, for the whole project.
For the whole project?
Yeah. And then the other people will give you 4, 5 hours, 6, 7 hours.
Mm.
To be honest, I always think that it's probably best that even if you have a contract and get it written down and signed to both parties, that would work quite well. I've read this in quite a lot of management books. I haven't done it, so I'm probably going to do it. But you just write a contract and say that, I'm going to give you a title, research fellow or whatever. And then, we sign that these are... we are committing to this project.
Interesting.
So that sort of thing I think works as well. But so all these steps I feel do work. And I've had quite a lot of success in these techniques because at one moment in my life I wasn't having that many successful projects. I was like, what is happening in all these projects? They start out nicely and then it's all will fade into nothing.
Yeah.
And then what I realized is that and then went away and I had to buy it for a long time and analyzed these projects in great detail. To be honest, at one point I spent 2-3 days not doing any research, just analyzing what went wrong. Spent 2-3 days doing this, just analyzing. And then I went and read all these management textbooks. And then it all came together for me. Okay, well, fine. This is how I should organize it.
Yeah.
And I spoke to a lot of people who do manage people. But I ended up disagreeing with a lot of their ideas. A lot of management ideas are based on negativity. So a common principle apparently is cover your ass. Basically, what you do is you make sure you're not getting blamed for anything. And if the project is failing, you blame the people doing it. You create these, you always have a secondary person who basically is supposed to stress out the first person. So the second person is like, oh, you're failing, the second person's there. So you stress out the first person. So these techniques work well in the corporate world probably, but I found them quite off-putting.
Not even there. I think that would create a toxic environment even there.
Yeah, that's the whole point. The corporate environment is a toxic environment, isn't it? Yeah. You weren't talking about the voluntary sector. This is voluntary. It's all voluntary, like charity work. So this person is doing a project trying to help other people. He's got good intent.
Agreed.
So, yeah.
I think this brings us to the end. I don't know. I think this was a very comprehensive insight into what you're doing right in order to get all these publications.
Yeah. Is it fine? Anybody can get publications. It's just a matter of using the right organization and discipline as something that people don't understand in research. Because the research, every time, is going to be a new project, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's going to be a new project. So what can you bring to the table? What you can bring to the table is a level of statistical knowledge, organization, teaching, training, working with the right people, things like that. You can bring that to the table, a disciplined, organized environment, which is similar to people that use their work. You've got a schedule. Every day you come in, go here, go there. What do you mean? Is it the word of God? Why do you end up in it? It'll say, go to Romford, yeah? Go to Romford and go to in this, and you end up in the middle of Romford. They could literally write, go to this abandoned building site, and you wouldn't challenge her. You'd go to abandoned building site, and this is a gang fight or something. You would just go, because as a medical student, you've been taught to obey orders. So what I'm trying to say is there's great benefit to an organized environment, and people find it very, very difficult to resist organization.
Mm.
So if you provide that within research, which is 90% of the time, is a disorganized environment with no concrete, but a fantasy world with fantasy characters, like almost like Snow White and the big bad wolf and stuff like that, in the sense that it is this fantasy of a paper that's going to get published.
Yeah.
But how did the how did Snow White end up going into coma from a poisoned apple? That doesn't make sense. Like, didn't she get bed sores? Yeah, so my point is that a lot of, how was she fed? Did she not die from not being fed? So my understanding of research is that you need to move away from the fantasy and create a real concrete way to do it in the same way as you do in your normal work. And that requires a level of what I call informal organization, that the other person thinks you're informal and I can say whatever I want and stuff like that. But there is an organization, which is quite extreme in many ways, but is almost invisible to the person in front of you. Yeah? And that works. So that person thinks, I can say anything I like, but there's all this organization that's been taught through in advance, and that works. And that way, these projects move really quickly. People get encouraged. Success breeds success. So he says, oh my God, I got my forest plot. Oh my God, I got my introduction. I got my this, I got my that. And then, my God, the whole project's like over in a matter of days and it's done. And then you move on.
And they want more?
Well, I usually give them a break. And then I work with somebody else. But in essence, it's fine. You're right. But you don't want to burn out people.
Yeah.
Success is dangerous. So I don't like people who publish a pile of papers when they're young. That's bad for you. Why is it bad? Well, there's three possibilities. One is that you're lucky, which is bad because, you're going to learn bad habits. The second possibility is you're working your arse off, which means that you're insane and you're going to burn out. So that's not good either. But third is there's a small subset of people who can work hard.
Yeah.
And be successful. But, you know, people like Albert Einstein were nasty. Albert Einstein was an absolute nasty human being.
Really?
Yeah. You know, he slept with his sister-in-law and stuff like that. And he was horrible to his wife. He was a nasty piece of work. A lot of these great scientists were absolutely nasty. Asimov was fine, but Newton. Newton was fine, but he never got married. And, Schrodinger.
Yeah.
Schrodinger was a pedophile. So I'm just saying, the problem is that these people, and this is what you find with higher level scientists and profs, they're not nice people generally. And so I was put off research. When I was younger, I did a lot of research, and then I just got put off and didn't want to do it anymore. Because it's like, what are these horrible people? What are they doing? Why are they doing research? I thought researchers want to help humanity. They're full of ego, arrogant, nasty people.
Yeah.
Research is full of that. Clinicians are nice. Researchers are horrible. Yeah? So this is something, a key aspect to understand. That in research, you generally don't find nice people. They're really horrible. So what it is about balance. So you need to have balance in your life. If you don't have balance in your life, you become a crazy person, isn't it? You're horrible to everybody around you because you have no balance. You don't know how much time to give to your work, how much time to give to your family, how much time to give to other things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to do some stuff which is outside of work, whether it's at least half an hour to an hour a day, reading or, you know, watching TV or whatever it is. You know, you need to do something outside of work.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're going to go crazy. Like, look at Boris Johnson, he's crazy. Like, if you see him, like, he's bonkers. These people are not normal. And they're not normal because they're extreme. You're much more likely to be happier if you live a moderate life, which means you do things within limits. And this is what comes back to the original thing and that's why I said you can only have one extra quiver, because why are you doing that? Why are you doing that to yourself? Why are you doing 10 things? You need to do your main job, and then you can do one other thing, and the rest of your time should be devoted to your family and to yourself.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? Make sure you get enough sleep, you exercise, spend time with your family, friends, whatever. Do all of the other things. They keep your mental health going.
Mm-hmm.
The reason these people become suicidal or burn out is because they're not doing the other things that you need to keep yourself sane. So there has to be limits to the amount of work you do in a day.
I would say take care of yourself first.
Yeah, but within limits. It shouldn't be an excuse for laziness, you know. Like,
of course.
So like some people I know, it's like, my God, they made me do some night shifts. You know, like, who's going to take care of these sick patients if you don't do the night shift? You have to be realistic, isn't it? You have to take care of other human beings as well. So the mental health is fine, but it's a limit to where you have responsibility, and these people suffer more than you. Like, some of my patients, they really suffer. And I had a dentist who came to see me, and he said, some of my patients are moaning at me, and I'm thinking, oh, look, I've got atrial fibrillation. I said, well, I can't say that to my patients. My job is like, climbing a mountain, and I'm the person who has to nail the nail into the mountain. If I don't do that, all the 9 people below me will fall and die. So my patients suffer endlessly, and I can never tell them that I suffer more than them, because their suffering is beyond belief. So, which is why I hate the doctor strike, and I oppose all of these strikes, because our responsibility is to our patients. You know, they truly suffer. They are truly in pain, and we can not even understand the amount of problems they have, and they should take priority over this other stuff. So mental health within limits, yes, fine, you should take care of your mental health, but don't, you know, make your patient suffer because of that assumption. That if it involves other people, then you need to take a backseat.
As much as I think there comes a point where if you're not well yourself, though, then that final nail, you won't even be able to put it. If you're overworking yourself and you're burning out. So there comes a point where that kind of takes precedence over.
Well, my point would be just put that nail in and then commit suicide, yeah? But just do it. To make sure you finish your job and finish that TTA before you hang yourself, yeah? Just make sure your job is completely. I'm all about responsibility, yeah?
Yeah.
I'm all about responsibility, yeah? So, you know, make sure you finish your job. No, this is critical. There are other human beings. Others first, yourself last. This is what I tell my junior doctors. They don't like this concept. Everybody else first, you should be last.
Yeah. I get that. I get that. But I don't know. I just feel like there's some certain points where, you know, if you commit suicide and then you're gone, then that's one less doctor. So that's worse on the other people. So it's in the benefit of everyone in the long term. So if you're better.
Yeah, yeah, I understand what you're saying. But people are using this excuse for laziness. Yeah. Honestly, they'll say, oh my God, I did one extra night shift and that person did one less night shift than me. And that means I'm getting mentally ill. Like, okay, fine, you know, like, but make sure you do that night shift.
Yeah.
So I understand, but these people don't understand mental illness sometimes, and they use it as an excuse. The reality is, yes, there are doctors who are mentally ill, and I think burnout is very real, and burnout is quite dangerous in the sense that burnout actually does mean that you cannot concentrate and you can't do your work. And I've had burnout a few times, and you have that problem where you literally aren't able to concentrate and do your job. And people do need to take vacations, and they need to at least 2 weeks a year they should go, take a vacation, go to another country, go do no work for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. That's critical. Otherwise, you know, you're going to wear down mentally. But in ordinary days, you have to do your job. You know, this is a vocation. If you came in this job to earn money, you're in the wrong profession. You're in this job because these people need you. Mm-hmm. They depend on you. They are in pain. The level of responsibility is far beyond any most jobs. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, probably you could say a fireman or a policeman is similar. Air traffic controller maybe is probably similar level of responsibility. But imagine air traffic controller, yeah? He's like, oh, I need to take a coffee break. Those planes can fly themselves, yeah? He has to complete his job. If my patient comes to see me, I don't order a certain test, and I don't make sure a certain referral is done, that patient will die. He will suffer. He will not get his treatment. It's not, you know, it's completely illogical when people come up with the fact that I should be allowed to use my mental health as an excuse not to do my job. You're fine. You can not do this job and you can do something else and you can go and leave. But you need to do that job at that point in time because that person is depending on you. And that person, if you don't do that job, nobody will take care of that person. The GP service is collapsing. Nobody's going to take care of that person. No, none of your colleagues are free. And a lot of people in the NHS no longer care. And the illness is on you. You are responsible. And not just for ordering that test or doing that, of listening to that person, of actually giving them somebody to listen to, so a person who might not have had anybody to talk to for months. You need to be that person for them. So I'm a bit crazy. I wouldn't recommend this, but a lot of my patients have my email address. Some of them even have my phone number. And one crazy patient texts me every day, but it's fine. He's got mental health issues. But I'm just saying, but that level of it's not possible for most people. But you can try. Why not?
I think this brings us to the end.
That's fine.
We've sent quite a few stuff. And I want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here and giving your time. And I think this is going to be a pretty useful podcast to hear through, especially for people who want to go into research, want to find a good supervisor, or for supervisors who want to find and complete some meta-analysis. And I also got to know some more stuff about you, which is very interesting, especially at the beginning. It was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.